Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm your host, Paul David, founder and CEO of Literal Humans. And I'm joined today by Tom Rudnai, who's going to be talking to us about connecting content to revenue with a big focus on demand generation. And so we want to really dig in and learn about what Demand Genius is doing to help companies tackle one of the most pressing challenges facing B2B companies today. Welcome to the pod, Tom.
Hey, thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Did I get your name right there, Tom? Just want to make sure.
That was actually one of the better... Tom or Rudnai are we talking about
here? Your surname. surname.
Tom, you nailed. Yeah, Rudnai, that was actually one of the better attempts that I've had. I've had everything from Red Eye to Rudini in my days.
Gosh. Well, glad I could get close there. Well, nice, nice to connect with you here. And yeah, we're excited to just dig in and you know, talk about how you're, you know, helping these content teams deliverable measurable impact at every step of the buyer journey. That's a big problem for us as an agency, because more and more we're being asked to demonstrate how we're helping them, you know, bring in real revenue and have that impact. So kudos to you for tackling that big problem.
Yeah, thank you. It's funny. It's something we kind of came to in a roundabout way, as is always the case with these things, right? Like, so my background, for a bit of context, is in like content experience. So we were helping media companies like BBC, FT, with their content gating, so dynamic paywalls, basically. And initially what we built was kind of bringing some of that into the B2B space, and then it just kind of morphed that we were like, oh, there's this much bigger problem that we've kind of accidentally solved. So it's funny how it always works out that way.
Yeah. It's amazing what gets built. You know, like, I think Slack initially was like a video game or something like that. And they were using this messaging tool to like message each other. And they're like, wait a minute, I think this messaging tool is actually our product. So,
yeah.
You know, you'd be surprised. But cool. Well, by way of intro, let's get our audience a bit more familiar with you. Tom, you've got a wealth of experience from the trenches of B2B sales and marketing before founding Demand Genius in April of 2024. Tom spent over 2 years at Zephyr, which was later acquired by Zuora. Lots of tough words in today's podcast. That acquisition happened for about the tune of $50 million USD, I think that it was. Over there, you played a key role in growing revenue from over 5 million ARR while working with elite media brands like the BBC, Financial Times, Forbes. You called out a few of those. You're also an active angel investor with a revenue syndicate. What's the deal with the revenue syndicate? What were they all about?
Cool. A guy called Misha and Jonathan that set it up. But just the idea is it's a syndicate of go-to-market professionals. So most of the investments tend to skew towards like GTM, sales, marketing, but they just surface deal flow for you. And it gives access to angel investing from a relatively low ticket size. So you're not kind of taking up a particularly meaningful kind of proportion of the cap table for any of these businesses. But it allows you to dip your toe in the water, which I think is really cool. If for anyone who's like looking to step up from individual contributor to more of a strategic role, it's such a cool way to learn about that, right? Like, it's founder prep for me. It was amazing. You get on all the investor updates of all these early stage companies, see what they do well, see what they do badly. Great learning experience.
That's great. We'll have to put a pin in that because that's definitely part of our repositioning as an agency is becoming more of a growth sort of go-to-market partner and looking to like tap into networks like that. So we'll put a pin in that, come back to that at some point. Getting back to Demand Genius, you know, I think what's particularly exciting about what you're doing is that you just announced a founding round led by Hatch, allowing you all to accelerate your vision of making B2B buying a more enjoyable experience, and by leveraging content intelligently throughout the buyer journey. So yeah, here we go. Two marketing guys talking about marketing. What could go wrong? let's dive in. You ready, Tom?
Yeah, let's do it.
So you most recently posted about, you know, a lot of top of funnel content reading like a sales pitch. We hear this from clients all the time. They're just done with like the salesy content. Unpack that a little bit. Like, what's broken about how B2B companies currently approach content marketing in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things. So like, I'll cover the research that we did recently, but then also more broadly. Like, broadly speaking, I don't know that anything's broken, but I think there's a lot of missed opportunities, right? So we live in a world where every single go-to-market operator is under a lot of pressure for go-to-market efficiency, right? We also are in a situation where 75% of B2B buyers avoid direct interactions with sales reps. So basically, our customers are begging us to engage more indirectly, right? Via one-to-many channels, which, guess what, are supremely efficient. So I guess our contention as a business is that content is more important now than ever because of changes that are happening in the way that B2B organizations buy software. And that that's something that we should all be leaning into when it, from a sales and marketing perspective, because it's an opportunity to reach people in a more efficient way that isn't pushing against their trends of how they want to engage. And I think a lot of what go-to-market at the moment is doing is intended to push against what their prospects want, right? We're desperately trying to get them on a call. We're trying to cold call them, that kind of aggressive outreach to push them to buy in the way we would like them to, because it's what we've always done, rather than look at how we can reinvent ourselves. It's where our background as both me and my co-founder in the media industry is really useful, because I think a lot of the adjustment we're having to make is just kind of trailing probably 15, 20 years behind what media companies had to do, where they completely rethink their whole business model to recognize the fact that people now engage and purchase their products digitally instead of reading a newspaper. So it's a cool opportunity, but it's a bit of a sorting function for the people who do and don't successfully adapt to that. In terms of the kind of research that we did lately, it was super interesting, actually. So we built an AI agent, which will run automatic content audits on a customer's site. So it was actually, again, we stumbled into it. Initially, we did this to automate the most arduous part of our own onboarding. But it builds this kind of complete directory of a customer's content, and it allows us to pull out insights of that. So what percentage of it is targeting which audience, which topic, like cool stuff for a content audit, but also where in the funnel is it targeting? And one of the things that we noticed from that is, while I think most, and I'll be clear that what we're assessing there with the AI is not the intent of the content, but the execution. And by that, I mean, it's not the keyword strategy that sits behind it, but the writing itself. And about 16% is top of funnel. Everything else skews a lot more middle and bottom of funnel. So it was a really interesting, revealing thing of, these are businesses that think they skew top of funnel, but when you read the content, they skew bottom of funnel, because we just can't resist talking too much about ourselves and our product.
Yeah, that's really interesting. How do you, you know, I want to ask you this question about the misconceptions that you see, you know, among content teams, but also thinking about brands too. Because I feel like, as you just said, brands, they have misconceptions about what their content is and the function it serves. And this is an active conversation for us. Like, we have clients who literally, you know, they've worked with them for years and they thank us because we bring them, you know, folks who have come in through top of funnel content or through website optimizations and things like that. But then they also scold us because they're like, we only want content that's focused on product and sales, and we don't actually care about search. And it's like, at the end of the day, you care about both. Right. Yes. And maybe you lean one way or the other, but you're not going to turn down this 75K new client that came in through, you know, all the search optimization that we've done for you. But you also want more stuff to, as you like to say, understand how sales is using your content. So like, how do we resolve these misconceptions on both sides, you know, as we're becoming more revenue focused, more go to market focused?
Yeah, well, I think if I'm understanding the question right, I think it changes the, so distribution of content has become a lot more complex, right? I think the traditional playbook, search and organic, was almost went hand in hand with content marketing, right? That was how you were discovered. I think that is changing a lot, where now I think distribution is a much more complex kind of mishmash of different channels. So search, the way I view search now is, it absolutely is a very powerful distribution channel. It's moved a little bit further down funnel because a lot of the top of funnel, like informational search terms, are going over to the AI overview. So it's a little bit more about capturing like highly specific intent driven BOFU terms, bottom of funnel, for anyone who doesn't live on LinkedIn and speak in acronyms. Divided my own train of thought there, but yeah, so that's one of many distribution channels. You also have paid, but I think one that is most overlooked is sales reps, and I should say sales CS, whoever it is, frontline teams that have direct access to prospects or suffer in a way that I don't think is talked about enough from what I call like the blank page problem, which I think is talked about a lot in terms of content marketers, but not in terms of a sales rep who's trying to nurture and engage someone over the course of a 6-12 month sales cycle. And you have the blank page problem. I was there. You know that you want to add value with all of your emails, not just chase them. But after two or three, like, I'm out of, you know, am I really going to keep writing an essay in every email to try and add value? So they need more help in being able to do that, particularly as it's harder and harder to engage directly. So I just think it's a misused or underutilized distribution channel that can help. If your goal for content goes beyond top of funnel metrics, but you're looking at like influence pipeline, influence revenue, like we talk a lot about intent signals in marketing. Well, they have the best intent signals you could ever imagine. They speak to the people. So I think putting a bit more focus on that is a good practice.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely see that shift. We're definitely pointing ourselves more towards sales teams. We're engaging with them more. We're, you know, now we even have a process where we have a kind of audience research expert. He's essentially a researcher, come in and interview five customers of our clients every single month. And then we turn those insights into content that we can quickly deploy to the sales team. So I think that's like kind of the model going forward, is like mining those insights and then quickly turning it into content that addresses those pain points. So,
yeah, for sure. Like there's a feedback loop that you need to establish between the two. And I think as content shifts from like this siloed function at the top of the funnel, which it was mostly mischaracterized at, but often lived as, that's even more important to break.
Right.
Out of interest, if I can ask a question back, like how do you find that as an agency building that? Do you find it, do you think it's easier or harder to do when you're external?
It depends. I mean, so it's a really good question. Look, a lot of our clients, they're not doing it internally. So in that sense, it's easy because it's you're coming to them with a clear value add of like, hey, you know, your teams aren't talking to each other, or you're not creating this feedback loop, or, you know, what have you. Harder in the sense in terms of getting access to their clients sometimes, embedding yourself with their teams, because a lot of brands aren't set up to create that connective tissue. And frankly, if they were, they wouldn't need us, which is, you know, I don't want to let the secret out, but like, you know, but that's kind of it. Like I would almost rather our clients, you know, have that set up internally and then bring us in to supercharge it, right? And to just, you know, supercharge the strategy and the output that maybe their team can't or won't do because they're focused on their customers. So
interesting.
So yeah, well, let's jump into Demand Genius as a product. We'd love you just kind of walk us through what Demand Genius actually does and maybe how it's different from traditional analytics platforms, for example.
Yeah, so I think the simplest way to put it is our focus is on helping marketers and, well, go-to-market teams, I should say, revenue teams leverage content more effectively throughout the customer lifecycle. So where typically content analytics platforms focus on measuring content metrics, right? Engagement, traffic, that kind of stuff. Our focus is very much on further down the funnel, understanding how is it impacting, like post-MQL in particular. What are people engaging with at each stage of the buyer journey, that kind of thing. So setting up marketers and content marketers to fulfill this down funnel or later life cycle role that we now believe they have. And that goes into a lot of different things. So the first part of it is measurement. So over, like at a glance, making it really easy to kind of see, okay, content as a whole, how much pipeline are we generating? How much closed run revenue are we generating? And you'd be amazed by how many content teams and marketers can't even track that just at a basic aggregate level, but then also like going into the next layer of detail so that you can start to look at what types of content, what topics are generating that, what people are engaging with at each point of the buyer journey as well. And that's the really crucial bit, is because we integrate with both the website and the CRM, we have really good data. So we know exactly what CMOs engage with in technical stage or what CTOs engage with in demo stage. And that's the insight that we can use to help content marketers very tactically with understanding where in the buyer journey are there gaps, right? So if we've got a 3, 6, 12 month sales cycle, where is content with a particular persona, content engagement dipping, and where is it rising, so that you can see how you're catering to all the different micro conversions within that sales process, but also so that you can feed that insight into distribution channels. And that's like the big focus area for us going forward. So one element that we've built initially because our background is content experience, right? So in each of those stages, based on the data that we have, what experience should people get? That's different at different points, right? Whether the gating decision should be, I always think, should be a lot less binary than we treat it as in B2B, right? It's not gate or don't gate on a piece of content and that decision driven by how proud we are of that piece of content. It's based on the reader, where they are on their journey, what we want them to do next. Is a form the right thing that's going to help us actually solve the problem and progress the deal, or is it not? So that's one example of like the insight and data that we provide. We want to make it super actionable so that you can start optimizing that. Another one is showing reps what to share with a CMO at each stage and making it really easy for them to add value with content in a way that we're suggesting they do. Eventually, we can go much further into paid distribution, all those other things. So like attribution, but our focus is always on adding the context wherever possible and making it super actionable.
And what's been the most surprising insight you've uncovered about how content impacts deals?
Well, it's a good question. The most surprising insight. I mean, I think it's difficult because of the stage we're at, right? We are still a kind of startup and we've raised our pre-seed. So we're not yet at the stage where we can have really reliable benchmark data across a broad range of, you know, 100,000 customers, which I'm pretty excited by what we can do from a content marketing point of view ourselves, actually. The best insight, I think I'll give you one, just the learning, which I hadn't realized actually, which was just the extent of the problem and the extent to which it is a time drain for marketers trying to get a grasp on the content that they have. Like this audit tool that we've built, there's two things. This audit tool that we've built, we did it to automate our own onboarding, right? We never intended for there to be value in that. What we found was that people were like, this took us hundreds of hours to do just to get a grasp on all of the content that we've produced over the last 5 years and have that in a single list so that we can start evaluating, like, where are the gaps? What are the trends? Things like that. So that lack of clarity that people had, even at a basic level, just on what they've done, really surprised me. But also the extent to which it's a time drain for ordinary marketers fielding requests for content from sales reps is something I actually didn't expect at the start. I thought the push was more for marketers to engage with sales reps.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's interesting to like have those insights pop up as you're working through the process with, you know, with clients, prospects, and things like that. So it's good that you uncovered that. Would love to dig into a bit more about your growth journey. I mean, you mentioned that you've just raised this pre-seed, you got this funding from Hatch. We're a growth partner, agency. Like, it'd be remiss if we didn't ask this, but like, what's your playbook for scaling in a market where a lot of companies are cutting budgets, a lot of them are turning to, you know, revenue attribution and sort of go to market metrics? It seems like it's going to be very quickly, or, and already is to some extent, in a saturated field. Plus you have like legacy players who maybe are just going to add this into, you know, their analytics. So how are you thinking about scaling and growing?
Yeah, I think there's two things I can probably say, and I can't look you in the eye and say that we figured this out, right? I completely agree with you. It's unbelievably noisy. I think it's the hardest time to do like scrappy founder-led sales that there's been, because you can spend like 20 minutes, half an hour researching and writing the most well-crafted, beautiful outreach message to someone, and it's just going to sit beneath 20 pieces of AI. I don't know if we can swear on this podcast, of AI messages. So, I think that is tough and it's something we struggled with. I think there's two things that, maybe three things that we're going to lean into. One is quality over quantity. So not playing the outreach. I'm just not really playing the outreach game, because I think you'll do damage to your brand in the long run. Another one is community. I think so. We partner with a great community of content marketers over in the US, which is like a small group of people where we can gain like unfettered access to our ICP, and kind of piggyback on the engagement that community sees. I think it's an increasing, I mean, people have probably heard the term dark social, but it's an increasingly important part of buyer journey. So I think the more you can embed yourself within those little groups, which is where actually a lot of decisions get made and people look for feedback from their peers now that they're spending a lot less time out in the office and out at networking events, I think that's always a good strategy. And the other one for us is lead with value as much as possible. Build stuff and put it in front of people and let it help them, and then figure out a little. That's one of the benefits of VC funding, is you can make long-term decisions. So like the content audit tool, we could probably charge for that, but then way less people would use it. And I'd much rather just get loads of people using it, add value to them. And then over time, we know we've got all of this stuff in terms of the attribution, that if and when they are ready, they can layer on top of it and become a paid customer. But I think it's something the barrier to entry to build software has become a lot lower. It's a lot cheaper to produce software. So I think increasingly thinking about how you can leverage software and a product as lead gen rather than traditional marketing tactics is a smart thing to do.
Yeah, it makes sense. Would love to dig a bit more into your like sort of personal journey. So you went from, you know, really smashing it in enterprise sales at Zephyr to kind of founding your own company. So curious to understand like what made you make those various leaps that you've made throughout your career. And if there was like a specific moment, just thinking about Demand Genius, where, you know, you realized that, you know, revenue attribution aligned to content was a problem worth solving.
Yeah, I think the most honest answer is probably ADHD. I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur, right? So, but what I first did after leaving university was I started a couple of different businesses and was trying to kind of see what stuck, and sadly nothing did. So at a point I had to go and get a grown-up job. But I've always loved, like, even then it was with a very early startup, that's always been my passion and what I enjoy doing. I would rather create a job than get one. I've actually historically been very bad at holding down jobs. So it's always like the first thought that I go to is, okay, what can I do? I planned to, after leaving Zawora, I had a great time at Zephyr, kind of progressed through my career pretty quickly there. I had some great kind of leaders above me who were willing to just stop me getting bored and keep throwing stuff at me. And then when we kind of went through the acquisition and went through like an 18-month cycle there, I was like, look, this is time. Planned to take some time off. I'm not very good at doing that. I kind of just sat at my desk and got interested in stuff. And before you know it, you're like, oh, there's a bit of a problem here. And I figured out that there was an opportunity to use all of the stuff that we've been doing for the last 5 years in terms of helping media companies, apply that to our own context and problems that I really understood well and solve them. And I think that realization, like when that's the approach that you're taking to starting a business, it allows you to shortcut a lot of the traditional steps in building a startup, right? Like if you think of the Y Combinator model where there's loads of customer interviews and stuff like that, it allows you to go through those a lot quicker because you're solving a problem that you understand so deeply.
Yeah. And super curious about your role as an angel investor as well. Like how has that perspective shaped how you've built your own company? Because now a lot of investors are also operators themselves. So yeah, how have you been able to use that to your advantage, would you say?
Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to oversell the angel investing, right? It's always something I did at a fairly small ticket size, just as a side hobby, because I find it super interesting. I think that in itself is an element, right? I love trying to figure out what early stage businesses are going to make it and why and things like that, right? So it's just intellectually interesting from that point of view. I also think, what's the best way to answer this? I think in terms of how it's changed my perspective, the biggest thing that comes to mind is in like the investor relations side of things. It gave me such a deeper understanding of what it is being on the other side of that table, that now I can apply it to how we interact with our own investors, right? So I invested in, I think it was like eight to 10 companies, all at a similar ticket size, which is just kind of good practice if you are doing angel investing. Don't be too emotionally swayed towards a big bet on one. But you saw of those 10, maybe 5 of them I ever actually even heard from the founder again, and a couple of them built really strong relationships with them, and they were then kind of people who gave me really great advice when I started out. So that was a valuable resource that I got from it. And if you're talking like 10, 20 grand across those investments, that's actually not a bad ROI for a couple of good advisors. But also just like the way that they update their investors, you learn so much. You learn from who's on it. You feel how that makes you feel about the investment a year later, and you see the difference for me in terms of how when something comes up in a conversation, I go and I promote that business for them. Nothing will ever attribute that impact, right? But it's there, and it's because they make me feel like I'm still a part of the journey. And that's something that I'm really keen that anyone who takes the leap of faith in investing with us, first of all, I recognize that they've taken a immensely flattering and powerful leap of faith in us, but also we build that so that they feel part of the journey so that we can get that unattributed impact.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot, and you probably feel this from being an investor yourself, but there's a lot to be said about, you know, reputation and sort of, you know, showing up with integrity of like, hey, I'm taking this money. I've promised you that I'm going to do X with it, and I'm going to make sure that I deliver on most of that. Obviously, you know, things happen. There's, you know, fluctuations in the market and changes of strategy, you know, shifts in budgets and all that stuff. But yeah, appreciate that position. That's one of integrity, you know, and not many people. A lot of people are very, very fast and loose and like, oh, let's take the money. We'll figure it out later. And that's not always a good thing, as you well know. So
we'll see how it goes. Maybe I'll change my mind next year and go on a holiday.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Well, let's jump into the lightning round. This is sort of like quick fire answers. It's just a chance to kind of get to know you a little bit better. Just like fun stuff. I want you to keep your answers quick and short as the name of the round suggests. Yes. But also give us, a little bit of rationale behind it if you can. So, you know, your answer in like a sentence or two, and that should give us a good picture. So first one, if you could found another tech startup, you know, let's assume Demand Genius just smashes it and you've got a bunch of money at hand, what would it be and why?
Very good question. Concise isn't my strength, but I'll do my best. It would be, I've got another business that I'm involved in as an early stage startup. It's kind of still in stealth and I'm just an advisor because obviously I have my own business to run. But it's kind of at the intersection of fantasy sports and sports betting and a bit of a passion project for me. So I would probably go and just commit all into that one instead.
Very cool. A lot of financial upside in that space right now as well, it sounds like. So.
For sure.
Second question, what tech invention right now makes you the most excited?
Oh, I mean, there's a great big giant elephant in the room, which is AI. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say I'm most excited for all the inventions that are to come off the back of that. I think AI is a cool tool. What is going to truly transform the world is all the hardware innovation that comes off the back of what AI, and I think that's when we'll actually start to properly unlock the benefits of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what makes you the most concerned? What tech invention makes you the most concerned right now?
Same answer. I just think as a society, we're not set up for the pace of change in technology at the moment, right? Like the way the ability of governments and people to keep up with the rate at which everything is going to shift and the suddenness with which shifts will happen is scary from a kind of, there's the doomsday fear of big red button gets pressed by an AI, but there's also just the social impact that things can have and how quickly they'll have them before we can react.
Yeah. And I feel that even at the company level as well. Like I see that there's lots of different groups of people and institutions, as you're suggesting, that have different levels of change resilience. And when you're trying to like move people along, you really see and feel that like the systems aren't there yet. And I would even say that people's attitudes aren't there yet in terms of their ability and willingness to be change resilient. So yeah, I agree with you on that one. It's a big one. While we're talking about humans, who's a literal human who's been integral to your career journey? You want to shout out?
Yeah, I'd have to say my co-founder. I think so. If you start a business, what people don't always tell you is just how lonely it can be and what an absolute roller coaster it is. Like I used to joke that, like, particularly in the early stages, one day I'm an entrepreneur and the next I'm unemployed. It's a very fine line and the swings are crazy. Like having someone who can support you and kind of keep you a little bit more level through that process is really important to helping you stick with it. And he's a rock.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what's an inspirational quote that stuck with you throughout your journey in tech?
So can I swear? Is that allowed?
Yes, yeah. You can. Yes, you can. It's encouraged even.
Nice. Okay. Anyone who follows cricket, Jos Buttler is an England cricket player. He used to write on his bat so that it was the last thing he saw before every ball, fuck it. And I just think that's a pretty good mentality to carry into life. But like any decision that you have to make, say fuck it. And whatever that makes you work towards is what you should do.
Yeah, I like that. It makes me think of like Jeff Bezos's like one door. Have you heard this one door and two door?
One-way doors,
yeah,
right?
One-way doors, two-way doors.
If it's a two-way door, just walk through it. If it's a one-way door, be careful.
Exactly, yeah. So like how do you apply fuck it to the one-way doors, I guess would be the question. But yeah.
There are times when my philosophy probably needs a little bit more thought. But day-to-day, I think it's a pretty good attitude.
Yeah. Maybe the two-way doors is fuck it. Maybe the one-way doors is think about it. You know?
Yeah. I think that's clear.
Yeah. That's a good one. I don't think we've had a cricket player quoted in that question yet. So you're on the board there as a first.
Nice.
So, well, listen, Tom, I think this has been a fantastic conversation. I mean, clearly Demand Genius is addressing something that every B2B company struggles with, you know, just proving that content, you know, really drives revenue rather than just vanity metrics. And it's exactly the kind of, I think, practical and data-driven solutions that can help companies build more sustainable and efficient growth. One, just editorializing on this, like, I think our profession, you know, as marketers is having a bit of a reckoning right now and a bit of a comeuppance. I think we've been, you know, if I'm being really honest, a bit lazy and a bit spoiled with these big budgets that have now contracted massively. And like now is a bit of a come to Jesus moment. And I appreciate that you're kind of leading the charge a bit here to kind of help us realize like, look, at the end of the day, our job is to help our clients like win bags of money. Like, let's be really serious. You know what I mean? Like, and just be humble about it. But that also presents an opportunity in terms of strategy and in terms of how we grow our profession and things like that. So it's great to see you kind of, you know, helping to lead that. So thank you.
Thank you. It's been a great chat.
Yeah. Where can folks find out more about Demand Genius and how you're helping content teams, you know, prove and improve their impact?
Yeah, two main places. Head to our website, www.demand-genius.com. Demand Genius was not available. And then LinkedIn, connect with me, Tom Rudnai, RUDNAI, and always happy to chat. And if you want us to run a free content audit on your site, which is the new AI tool that we've built, then also just ping me. We're doing them manually at the moment and testing them, but more than happy to.
Cool. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in. It's been a great conversation with Tom Rudnai, founder and CEO of Demand Genius. As always, please give us a review, especially if you enjoyed the episode. Give us 5 stars. It really helps us bring on founders like Tom who are solving real problems for growing companies. So thanks everybody for listening. It's been another great episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. And we're talking today with Tom Rudnai, founder and CEO of Demand Genius, about connecting content to revenue. Thanks, everybody. Have a good one. Thanks, Tom.
Cheers. Bye-bye.